Welcome back, Deep Divers. Today, we're plunging headfirst into colonial India.
A fascinating period, undoubtedly.
Oh, absolutely. But we're going beyond the usual political and economic upheavals. We're digging deeper into the cultural blend where Indian and British influences collided and, well, sometimes created something totally new.
You're talking about the emergence of hybrid identities.
Exactly. We're going to see how colonialism reshaped people's sense of self. And the really exciting part, we've got a fantastic mix of sources to work with.
Oh, absolutely.
Historical accounts to set the stage, glimpses into art and architecture where these cultures literally merged, and even analysis of political movements fueled by this cultural mix. It's going to be a wild ride.
It's remarkable how these sources, when examined together, reveal the intricate tapestry of colonial India. East meets West, tradition clashes with modernity, and you see these moments of cultural brilliance emerging from a rather oppressive system.
It's a story full of contradictions, that's for sure. And speaking of contradictions, I was struck by how the East India Company, this massive trading force, initially landed in India. And, well, they seemed almost clueless about the complexities of the land beyond its economic potential.
It's a common misconception that they arrived fully prepared.
Right. Imagine they barely spoke the languages. I mean, how did they even fathom governing such a vast and diverse population? It's mind-boggling.
It highlights a crucial aspect of early colonial encounters. The British were largely unprepared for the cultural nuances. The lack of language skills, as you mentioned, speaks volumes about their initial approach. Trade was the priority, not genuine understanding.
So it's like showing up to a dinner party, no idea about the customs, the food, even what language everyone's speaking. You're bound to make some major faux pas, right? So how do they go from, well, fumbling guests to rulers?
There was a gradual shift, of course. Figures like Edmund Burke emerged, advocating for a trustee role for the British in India.
A trustee?
Yes. This paternalistic concept, though inherently problematic, shaped their approach. They attempted to justify their control by framing themselves as guides. Guides for a supposedly less developed civilization.
Trustee. It almost sounds benevolent, doesn't it? But so far from the reality of exploitation.
Precisely. The term itself reveals the inherent contradictions of colonialism. On one hand, they believed in uplifting India, bringing progress, but this progress always came at a steep price, fueling British interests, of course, often neglecting the needs and voices of the Indian people.
A very convenient kind of progress, it seems. And as the British solidified their authority, we see these fascinating hybrid spaces and institutions popping up. It's like a blend of British structures with Indian realities, a very tangible manifestation of this cultural exchange, wouldn't you say?
Absolutely. Take, for instance, the introduction of municipal boards. They were designed to bring a semblance of local governance, encouraging Indians to participate in civic duties, at least to some extent.
It sounds, well, almost democratic in a way, but I imagine it wasn't that simple.
No, not quite. The way these boards were structured, particularly the nomination practices, they often intensified existing social divisions.
So while promoting, on the surface, a sense of unity under the British crown, they were also, unintentionally or not, exacerbating the fault lines of religion and caste that already ran through Indian society.
Precisely. It's a potent example of how colonial intentions often clashed with the complexities of the Indian social fabric. These boards, instead of fostering unity, inadvertently reinforced communal identities.
And I imagine that legacy continues to have repercussions even today.
Oh, absolutely. Political and social ramifications that are still felt in India today. It's a stark reminder of the lasting impact of those seemingly mundane administrative structures.
Wow. So even seemingly minor decisions had far-reaching consequences. It seems like every aspect of life became a site of this cultural tug of war. And nowhere is this more visually evident than in the art and architecture of the time, right?
Absolutely. It's a feast for the eyes, really. We see this incredible fusion of styles where Mughal architectural elements are incorporated into British constructions.
I'm picturing those grand buildings with their intricately carved domes and those elegantly curved roofs, so typical of Mughal architecture. It's like a visual representation of this cultural blending happening all around. But it also makes me wonder about the motivations behind it. Was it genuine admiration or a more calculated move to, well, legitimize British rule?
It's a complex question, isn't it? And the answer is likely a mix of both. You have British officials genuinely captivated by the beauty and grandeur of Mughal architecture. But on the other hand, it's hard to ignore the element of appropriation, adapting the symbols of a conquered culture to solidify their own authority.
So it's a bit of both then.
Precisely. Take, for instance, the Jahangiri Mandir. It showcases this fusion of styles beautifully.
It's almost like they were saying, look, we appreciate your culture, we're incorporating it into our own, but at the same time, there's this subtle reinforcement of their power, like saying, we are now the patrons of this style, this legacy.
A very astute observation. It's a reminder that cultural exchange during colonialism was rarely, if ever, a neutral phenomenon. It was deeply entangled with power dynamics. The colonizer often dictating the terms of the exchange.
Of course. But even within these constraints, I imagine Indian artists and architects found ways to assert their own agency, their own creativity.
Absolutely. They adapted and reinterpreted those imposed styles, creating something uniquely their own, a subtle act of resistance, you might say.
So even in these structures that on the surface represent British power, there's this undercurrent of cultural reinterpretation happening, a fascinating dynamic. And as we move into the late 19th century, this cultural blend also starts to fuel the rise of Indian nationalism.
Right, exactly. We see these early organizations like the Indian Association and the Mahajana Sabha starting to challenge colonial policies head on.
Advocating for Indian interests.
Precisely. This period marks a crucial turning point. Indians, exposed to Western education and ideas, began to articulate a distinct vision of their own nationhood.
And I imagine these organizations provided platforms for some really remarkable individuals to emerge.
Absolutely. Figures like Surendranath Banerjee, who navigated the complexities of colonial education and emerged as a powerful voice advocating for self-rule.
It's inspiring to see how individuals like Banerjee, despite facing discrimination within a system designed to uphold colonial authority, managed to turn that very education into a tool for resistance. It speaks volumes about the resilience and adaptability of the Indian people.
It's a testament to the indomitable spirit that fueled the Indian independence movement. And as these nationalist sentiments gained momentum, they paved the way for the formation of the Indian National Congress, a pivotal moment in India's struggle for freedom.
Absolutely. But this burgeoning sense of Indian identity wasn't a monolithic force, was it? I mean, we see these different visions of what it meant to be Indian emerging and sometimes, well, clashing with each other.
You're absolutely right. The late 19th century witnessed a rise in communal tensions, particularly between Hindus and Muslims. Tensions that found expression in literature, political discourse, really every facet of life.
It's almost like a mirror image of what we saw with the British, right?
Yeah.
This idea that a single identity could encompass such a diverse population was constantly being challenged, both from within and without.
It really is fascinating how this idea of a unified Indian identity was, you know, being contested and reshaped both by the colonial presence and by internal debates about religion, about culture, about tradition. And these debates, these very debates, played out in really fascinating ways, particularly in the literature of the time.
Yes, the source material had some really compelling examples of this, that's for sure. On one hand, you have figures like Swami Vivekananda, a Hindu spiritual leader who, while promoting Hindu pride, also emphasized the importance of, well, universal values and unity.
Right. Vivekananda's vision, you see, was rooted in Vedanta philosophy, which, just as a reminder, emphasizes the interconnectedness of all beings. So he saw Hinduism not as a rigid set of beliefs, but as a dynamic tradition, a tradition capable of embracing, you know, diverse perspectives. His message resonated deeply with many Indians who were, I think, seeking to reconcile their cultural heritage with these new modern ideas.
Yeah, it's such a nuanced approach, recognizing the richness of Hindu tradition while also looking outward, embracing this more inclusive vision. It's really quite remarkable. But then you have writers like Bankim Chandra Chatterjee, whose novels were incredibly popular, yes, but also fueled a different kind of nationalism.
Bankim's work often evoked a sense of Hindu triumphalism, you know, glorifying a past where Hindus were dominant. And while this resonated with some who felt marginalized under colonial rule, it also contributed to, I'd say, growing anxieties among Muslim communities.
It's a good reminder that even within a movement for independence, there were these, well, competing visions of what a free India would look like, who would be included and how power would be shared. It wasn't just this simple unified front. And on the Muslim side, we see figures like Altaf Hussain Ali and Abdul Halim Sharar actively responding to these anxieties and, of course, the broader challenges of colonialism.
Yes, absolutely. These writers were deeply concerned with the impact of, well, you know, British critiques of Islam, which often portrayed it as backwards and incompatible with progress. So their writings aimed to, you know, foster a sense of pride among Muslims, emphasizing the richness of Islamic history, Islamic culture.
It's really interesting how these cultural and literary movements mirrored the political tensions of the time. It wasn't simply a struggle against British rule. It was also a struggle over how to define Indian identity itself and how different communities would fit into that vision. A very layered struggle, it seems.
Exactly. And this interplay of cultural and political forces wasn't, you know, confined to just the intellectual elite. It really permeated everyday life, shaping social customs, personal identities in, well, really profound ways.
One thing that really struck me was how the British, despite their initial, you know, ignorance, eventually developed a fascination, even an appreciation for certain aspects of Indian culture. We see British officials immersing themselves in Indian languages, collecting artifacts, even adopting some Indian customs and styles of dress. It's an interesting shift.
It is fascinating, isn't it? On the surface, it might seem like cultural exchange, even admiration. But it's important to remember that this fascination often took the form of exoticism, you know, a way of othering Indian culture, framing it as something curious, something beautiful, but ultimately subordinate to British norms.
Ah, yes, that classic colonial gaze, where the colonized culture is viewed as this source of fascination and study, but always from a position of power, from a position of assumed superiority.
Precisely. But we also see Indians engaging with British culture, British ideas, though often, of course, with a critical lens. The introduction of Western education, for example, had a profound impact on Indian society.
Right. And it's kind of interesting to think about how access to these institutions, while designed to promote, you know, British values and solidify their control, also inadvertently created spaces for critique, for resistance.
That's right. Many Indians embraced English literature, philosophy, scientific ideas. But they didn't simply absorb them passively. No, they adapted and reinterpreted those ideas, you see, through their own cultural frameworks, challenging colonial assumptions and forging new paths of intellectual inquiry.
Like taking the tools of the colonizer and turning them into weapons for, you know, intellectual liberation. A very clever strategy, it seems.
Yes, a brilliant way to put it. And this dynamic exchange, this interplay of cultural influences, really play a key role in shaping those hybrid identities we talked about earlier.
Right. It's not just individuals adopting certain customs or styles. It's about navigating this really complex web of cultural expectations, negotiating multiple identities, and ultimately forging something new, something unique.
Exactly. Think of those individuals who embraced, for example, Western education, but also remained deeply rooted in their own cultural traditions, or those who found ways to, you know, blend elements of British fashion with Indian styles, creating this new aesthetic that really reflected their, well, their dual identities.
It reminds me of, you know, how food often evolves in these cultural contact zones. You might have a dish that originates in one culture, but then gets adapted and transformed, incorporating local ingredients, local flavors. It becomes something entirely new while still carrying echoes of its origins. A delicious kind of fusion, you might say.
That's a perfect analogy. And these hybrid identities, they weren't limited to a specific class or region. They permeated all levels of Indian society, from the urban elite to the rural communities, shaping, really, the very fabric of daily life.
So it wasn't just happening in, like, grand buildings or intellectual debates. It was happening in the music people listened to, the clothes they wore, the language they spoke, the very way they interacted with the world around them.
Precisely. This cultural fusion, this dynamic exchange of ideas, of customs, really, became woven into the tapestry of Indian society. And while colonialism certainly exerted its influence, you know, Indian agency and creativity were crucial in shaping the outcomes of these encounters.
Right. It's a good reminder that history isn't just about, you know, domination and oppression. It's also about resilience, adaptation, and the power of human creativity to transform even the most, well, challenging circumstances.
Precisely. And this brings us to, I think, a crucial question. How did these hybrid identities, forged under such complex circumstances, continue to evolve after India gained independence?
Yeah, it makes you wonder, doesn't it? Did they simply vanish with the end of colonial rule? Or did they continue to adapt and transform, shaping the cultural landscape of, you know, modern India? What aspects of those identities have endured, and how have they been reinterpreted in this post-colonial era?
Yeah, it's a really intriguing question, isn't it? How these hybrid identities born out of such a complex period, you know, continued to evolve in a post-independence India. Did they fade away, or did they maybe become even more deeply ingrained in the culture?
Well, it's a complex, that's for sure. Not a simple answer. The legacy of those hybrid identities is, I think, woven into the very fabric of modern India, but it's a legacy that's been both celebrated and, you know, contested. So it wasn't just a matter of, like, erasing all traces of British influence and starting fresh.
No, not at all. India's journey after independence involved a process of reclaiming and, you know, redefining its own identity. And that process inevitably engaged with those hybrid forms that had emerged during the colonial period.
Right, because as we saw, the struggle for independence itself was shaped by these, well, different visions of what it meant to be Indian. You had figures like Gandhi advocating for a return to those traditional values, while others, like Nehru, embraced a more modernist vision, incorporating, I guess, aspects of Western thought and governance.
Exactly. And those tensions, I think, continued to play out in the decades following independence. On one hand, there was this very real desire to shed the vestiges of colonial rule, to assert a distinctly Indian identity free from Western influence, you know. But on the other hand, many of the institutions, ideas, and cultural practices that had taken root during the colonial period remain very much embedded in society. So it's this push and pull, this tension between the two.
So it was a balancing act, right? Navigating between reclaiming the past and forging a new future for India.
Exactly. And this played out in various spheres of life. Take architecture, for example. After independence, there was this very conscious effort to move away from the Indo-Saracenic style that had been so prevalent, I'd say, during the British Raj. And so architects began experimenting with modernist forms, incorporating elements of traditional Indian design, but with this distinctly contemporary aesthetic.
So it's like saying, okay, we're not simply going to erase the past, but we're going to, you know, reinterpret it, create something new that reflects our own vision for the future.
That's a great way to put it. And we see similar trends in literature, music, even fashion. There was this surge of creativity as Indian artists and thinkers sought to express, you know, their newfound freedom and reimagine their cultural heritage.
So these hybrid identities, instead of disappearing, actually provided a foundation for this new wave of creative exploration.
In many ways, yes. They offered this framework for navigating those complexities of post-colonial identity,
yeah.
You know, for blending tradition and modernity in ways that really resonated with a newly independent nation.
But it wasn't always this, like, smooth, seamless process, was it? I imagine there were tensions and disagreements about how to reconcile the past with the present.
Oh, absolutely. The legacy of colonialism continued to cast a long shadow. And the question of how to deal with that legacy, how to come to terms with its impact on Indian culture and society, remained a source of, you know, debate and contention.
And, I mean, we see this play out in contemporary politics as well, right?
Yeah.
These debates about language, about education, even the very symbols of national identity, you know, they often reflect those underlying tensions.
Precisely. The ghosts of the colonial past, they really do continue to haunt the present, shaping political discourse and influencing how Indians see themselves and their place in the world, I think.
It's a good reminder that history isn't just a collection of facts and dates. It's this living force that continues to shape our present, shape our future.
Mm.
And as we, you know, delve into these complex historical narratives, we inevitably confront our own assumptions, our own biases, and I think that's really important.
And I think that's the power of these deep dives, isn't it? They challenge us to, you know, think critically about the past, to grapple with its complexities, and to consider how those historical forces continue to shape, you know, the world we live in today.
Yeah, absolutely. We've journeyed through, well, a period of immense change and transformation. We've witnessed the clash and fusion of cultures, the rise of those hybrid identities, and of course, this enduring legacy of colonialism. It's been quite a journey.
And as we wrap up this deep dive, we really do invite you, our listeners, to continue exploring this fascinating chapter of history. You know, delve deeper into the lives of the individuals we've discussed, explore the art, the literature, the social customs that shaped this era. There's always more to uncover.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, we've only just scratched the surface, and there's so much more out there to discover.
And most importantly, I think, reflect on how these historical forces might be shaping, you know, your own world today. How do you see the legacies of colonialism playing out in your own community, in your own country, in your own understanding of the world?
It's a question worth pondering, for sure. And we encourage you to, well, continue the conversation. You know, share your thoughts on our website, engage with us on social media, and, of course, keep diving deep.
Because understanding the past is, well, absolutely essential for navigating the present and shaping a more just and equitable future for everyone.
Thanks for joining us on this deep dive into colonial India. We hope you've gained, you know, a new appreciation for the complexity of cultural synthesis and that you'll continue to ponder the enduring legacy of these, well, these historical encounters. Until next time, keep exploring.